Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingari. Next hour, national correspondent Bob Ney will check in. We'll hear about the mascot controversy in Rutland, and we'll finish the program speaking with Governor Phil Scott. But this hour is all about fermentation, and we are lucky enough to have with us fermentation expert Sandor Ellix-Katz, who has a new book out, published by Chelsea Green Publishing, called Sandor Katz's Fermentation Journeys, Recipes, Techniques, and Traditions from Around the World. He joins us now. Sandor Katz, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's great having you. Listeners, to ask Sandor a question about fermentation, or if you want to share how fermentation has played a part in your life, you can give us a call. 244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. Or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sandor, how long have people been fermenting the food and drink that they consume?
It's hard to say. I mean, the archaeological record has found, evidence, pottery shards with residues, of fermentation practices going back at least 10,000 years. But, you know, I would say that this tells us more about the history of pottery than it does about the history of fermentation, because presumably the, earlier vessels that people were fermenting in were things that are completely biodegradable, whether it's wood or gourds or animal membranes. So, you know, what we know is that the practice of fermentation is ancient. And really, that fermentation does not require human intervention. I mean, fermentation is a, spontaneous, natural event that, humans at some point observed and figured out techniques to, make happen on our terms. But they're natural phenomenon that occur with us or without us.
How and when did your interest in fermentation get started?
Well, let's see. I mean, I grew up loving pickles. And, my household, like most households on planet Earth, we enjoyed some products of fermentation. I was familiar with yogurt. I was familiar with sauerkraut. I was familiar with, bread and cheese. But pickles were really the flavor of fermentation that I loved as a kid without thinking about fermentation. When I was in my mid-20s, I spent a couple of years following a macrobiotic diet, and macrobiotics really places some emphasis on the digestive benefit of pickles and other live ferments. And I started noticing during that period that these pickles that I've been enjoying my entire life, whenever I would eat them, I could feel the salivary glands under my tongue squirting out saliva, and I began to associate these foods with getting my digestive juices flowing in a very tangible way. But even then I wasn't making them myself. Like, really the impetus to learn how to ferment myself came when I moved from my hometown of New York City to rural Tennessee, where I've been living for the last 30 years, and started keeping a garden. And I mean, I was such a naive city kid, it had never occurred to me that in a garden all the cabbage would be ready at about the same time and all the radishes would be ready at about the same time. So, once I encountered this, rather obvious aspect of agricultural production, agriculture, I learned how to make sauerkraut because I had a nice row of cabbage in that first garden, and I learned how to make sauerkraut from the joy of cooking, and I couldn't believe how straightforward it was. I couldn't believe how delicious the kraut that I made was. And, then I started experimenting. What if I use turnips instead of cabbages? What about a sourdough starter? How does that work? How do you make yogurt? And I really, went into the rabbit hole of fermentation.
And you have proudly carried the nickname of Sandor Kraut. How did that get started?
Well, once I got excited about fermentation, I was fermenting everything, and whenever I would be invited to somebody's house, I'd show up with my latest project, and one of my old friends dubbed me Sandor Kraut, and the nickname has stuck even as my repertoire diversified.
And your new book is called Fermentation Journey. So what will readers find in the new book?
Well, basically I have had the wonderful privilege of being invited to teach all around the world. And, you know, anywhere where I've gone to teach, I've also been eating and learning about fermented delicacies in those places. And, you know, this book is, you know, primarily about foods and beverages that I have learned about in my travels.
And we should mention that here in Vermont, we've had the good fortune of having you teach a workshop at Sterling College in Craftsbury. So some people got to really know you quite well. I think they had kind of a quickly full class or for that workshop.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've actually taught in Craftsbury at Sterling College maybe a half a dozen times.
Wow.
So I've had a lot of great experiences there. I've also taught in Burlington. I've taught in Southern Vermont. I've done classes at Bread and Puppet. I've taught a lot in Vermont, and there's just, you know, always been huge interest in fermentation there.
Yeah. Now, before we get too far into our journeys and talking about the new book, give us a primer of what exactly fermentation is, what foods and beverages use fermentation, and, you know, how you became kind of the Johnny Appleseed of fermentation.
So broadly speaking, I would define fermentation as the transformative action of microorganisms. And, I mean, fermentation is certainly not limited to foods and beverages, but, you know, in this context, we're really talking about, you know, foods and beverages that are created through the action of microorganisms. You know, this describes an incredible range of foods and beverages that people enjoy all around the world. I mean, fermentation is practiced everywhere. I do not possess encyclopedic knowledge, but, you know, I have been looking for counterexamples for 25 years of, you know, people that, you know, don't incorporate fermentation into their, you know, culinary arts, and I have not been able to find any examples of that. Fermentation is quite nearly universal. And, you know, my thinking about why this is so is the simple fact that microbiology has illuminated for us that, you know, all of the plants and all of the animal products that make up our food are populated by microorganisms. So there's a certain inevitability to microbial transformation of our food. And, you know, not every microbial transformation of our food results in something delicious that we wish to eat. But as a practical matter, if people want to avoid their food, you know, decomposing into something disgusting that they would never want to eat, then they need to guide the microbial development. So, you know, there's always a practical benefit to fermentation. You know, rather than the food decomposing into something disgusting that we wouldn't eat, it becomes more delicious. It becomes more easily digestible. It becomes more stable for long-term storage. We remove some toxic element from the food. There's always a practical benefit to fermentation. As far as examples of it, I mean, almost everybody in almost every part of the world eats and drinks products of fermentation every day. You know, my imaginary person that might be listening to this, sitting in their kitchen or in their car in Vermont, most of them probably already had something fermented this morning. Coffee is fermented. Bread is fermented. Cheese is fermented. Cured meats are fermented. Condiments are either directly fermented, like the ancient condiments of the world, fish sauce and soy sauce, or else they rely upon vinegar, a product of fermentation, to stabilize them. Chocolate is fermented. Vanilla is fermented. Obviously, alcoholic beverages are all fermented, and a huge range of non-alcoholic beverages. I mean, there's this whole world of what I would call lightly fermented beverages along the lines of kombucha, which are, you know, can become bubbly, but with very limited alcohol. So, I mean, there's just a huge range of fermented foods. There's no food that we can possibly eat that cannot be fermented. Anything can be fermented in a range of ways.
I've already had mine. No, not an alcoholic beverage. I had yogurt this morning, so I've had a fermented item already today. Geographically, where do you take us in the new book, Sandor Katz's Fermentation Journeys?
Well, I mean, pretty much all around the world. I mean, I have lots that I learned about in China and in Japan. You know, also things that I've learned about in South America, in Mexico, in Europe. I also write about some, you know, really interesting West African ferments. But you know, the book really travels all around the world.
All right. Sandor, what are the benefits of having fermented foods and drinks as part of your regular diet?
Well, I mean, first of all, because fermented foods and beverages are so varied, you know, it's important to recognize that, you know, they don't all have the same, you know, nutritional qualities. But the process of fermentation definitely transforms foods in some very clear patterns of ways and, you know, offers some very distinct benefits to us. You know, the first way that fermentation transforms foods I would describe as pre-digestion. And this is the simple idea that, you know, while the food is fermenting, nutrients are being broken down by the microorganisms that are driving the fermentation. So, for instance, I think maybe the most vivid illustration of this would be soybeans. Soybeans are considered to be the plant food with the most concentrated protein, but the limitation is that our human digestive systems cannot really effectively extract the protein from a soybean that has simply been soaked and cooked. And this was recognized really by the Asian cultures that pioneered soy agriculture thousands of years ago, and they developed all of these different ways of fermenting the soybeans. So, you know, among the popular soy foods are soy sauce, miso, tempeh, natto. These foods are very different from one another in their fermentation processes and organisms and the procedures for making them. But what they all have in common is that the protein gets broken down into amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. And so this is pre-digestion. Lactose, the milk sugar that so many people have a hard time digesting, gets broken down under fermentation, and many people who cannot drink a glass of milk without experiencing problems actually find that they can eat yogurt. Or sometimes they can only eat yogurt if it's very well fermented, meaning fermented for a long time, enabling more of the lactose to be broken into lactic acid. So pre-digestion, you know, frequently makes the nutrients in foods more bioavailable to us. Then a second way that fermentation transforms nutrients in foods I would describe as detoxification. And this is really exactly the same thing as pre-digestion, except instead of breaking down potentially nutritious compounds, it's breaking down potentially toxic compounds into harmless forms. And, you know, there are certain foods that have high levels of cyanide that can be broken down under fermentation. There are foods high in oxalic acid, which is an irritant to many people, which can be broken down under fermentation. So various, you know, toxins that are, you know, inherent in the plants that they grow in can be broken down by fermentation, making otherwise poisonous or troublesome foods safer or easier for people to eat. Then fermentation also generates additional nutrients. Almost all fermented foods and beverages have elevated levels of B vitamins compared to the foods that you begin with, as well as, you know, what I would call micronutrients, essentially metabolic byproducts of the fermentation that are being found to have some kind of therapeutic benefit. So, for example, fermented vegetables have these compounds called isothiocyanates, which are regarded as anti-carcinogenic, and they develop as a byproduct of the bacteria that are fermenting the vegetables. Natto, the Japanese soy ferment, has a compound that's gotten a lot of attention called natto kinase that has been found to dissolve fibrin, which is the substance that sometimes builds up inside people's blood vessels, constricting circulation. Certain ferments have very specific beneficial compounds that develop. But finally, what I would consider to be the most profound benefit of fermented foods and beverages would be the bacteria themselves. Hmm. And, we've come increasingly to recognize that, bacteria are part of us, that we need bacteria, in order to be healthy. And, an average healthy adult is host to trillions of bacteria, just mind-boggling numbers, but in diminished biodiversity compared to people in the past, due primarily to chemical exposure and changes in our diet, eating less fiber. Eating live culture fermented foods that have not been cooked or heat processed after their fermentation can be an excellent strategy for restoring biodiversity and biodiverse gut, can really impact upon our digestive processes, our immune function, and regulating many of the other chemical processes in our bodies. So it's really related to every aspect of our health and well-being. And, eating live fermented foods, like taking probiotics, can be a strategy for restoring biodiversity and potentially improving digestion, immune function, and many other aspects of our health and well-being.
You mentioned how varied the food and drink fermented items are throughout the world. Is there a fermented food that you found that is made in just about every culture in the world, maybe with some variations?
Well, that's interesting. I would say certainly the most widespread form of fermentation would be the production of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And, people make alcohol from, pretty much every carbohydrate source that is available, including milk. People make alcohol out of every, plant sap, fruit, grain, every carbohydrate source. So I would say, probably the production of alcohol would mm-hmm. be the most widespread. But of course, the specific forms of alcohol are extremely varied because, the carbohydrates that are abundant in different places are so varied. So for instance, I have a section of the book that is about pulque. And pulque mm-hmm. is this wonderful Mexican fermented beverage from the sap of the maguey plant, and which is a dryland succulent. It's a really beautiful plant, that thrives in a very specific environment, and it's a bit of a production to extract the sap, but then the sap is so sweet and delicious. The name for it in Spanish is agua miel, water honey. Mm. And it just ferments into this lovely beverage called pulque. So, I would say alcoholic beverages are the most widespread form of fermentation, but the specifics of that are extremely varied in different environments.
Well, I do want to ask you about another alcoholic drink that you had. I think the first time was years ago. This is in Africa. Palm wine. I'm really intrigued because you mentioned how delicious you found it the first time you had it in Africa. Can you tell us about palm wine?
Sure. Well, in my youth, when I was 23 years old, I spent about 5 months crossing the Sahara Desert into tropical West Africa. And, passing through Algeria and the desert, there was no alcohol to be found. But as we, got down into Niger and increasingly tropical West Africa, we started seeing people selling palm wine. And, you know, first of all, we were thrilled to see alcoholic beverages available at all.
Right.
And it was my first time ever drinking any kind of a homemade alcoholic beverage. It was always served out of open vessels. It was like it's a white, milky, kind of starchy, appearing beverage, but really, really delicious. And at this point I've had, palm wines, you know, not only there, but also in Burma and in Indonesia and really in a lot of tropical places with palm trees. You know, people extract sap in different ways, you know, in order to ferment it.
Now, as we continue, Sandor, please feel free to correct my attempts at pronouncing some of the items in the book. I am getting a bit hungry, so I love the recipe from Croatia for sarma. I'm Slovak. We call them holubki, but the one thing that I really enjoyed is they add bacon, which we don't do that in Slovakia. But tell us about that dish, sarma.
Sure. So sarma is stuffed cabbage.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really special about this style of stuffed cabbage is that the heads of cabbage are fermented whole first. And that takes about 6 weeks. But then once they're fermented, then you can peel off individual leaves, and they're pliable, and you can stuff them with rice and meat stuffing in the case of the style of sarma that I have a recipe for in the book, and then you steam them. So it's really quite a production, but it's so delicious. Oh, my God. You know, I just love sarma, especially, like, you know, with the cold weather coming on. Mm-hmm. To me, it's just one of the ultimate, you know, kind of warming comfort foods. You know, you cook it for a couple of hours, so it just fills the whole house with a beautiful aroma. And I also love the ritual of fermenting the whole heads of cabbage. And I found that throughout the southeastern Europe, the former Yugoslavia lands, you know, this is the primary way of fermenting cabbage. Rather than shredding it, salting it, and then fermenting it, the heads are fermented whole, or rather almost whole, because you cut out the core. You remove like a conical shape that's core. And then the way I learned how to do it is you fill those with salt and then pack them into your, you know, crock or bucket or whatever the vessel you're working with is. And then once they're all packed in, you just cover them with water, and the salt dissolves into the water, and they readily ferment.
All right, we're going to take a break and then come back after the news to hear more about fermentation with Sandor Katz. Listeners, you can join the queue to speak to him, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We've got the Sox tonight. Open up that big three-game series at Fenway with the Yankees. Our coverage begins 6:10, game time 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Fermentation may be trendy, but it is by no means new nor confined to our little corner of the world. Author Sandor Katz has joined us this hour to share recipes, techniques, and traditions from his newest book, Sandor Katz's Fermentation Journeys. Listeners, if you've got questions or comments for Sandor, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Before the break, Sandor, we were talking about sarma in Croatia. Cabbage plays a role in many of the fermented dishes in cultures around the world. First of all, why is that?
Well, okay. One thing is that, you know, cabbage is a vegetable that people usually harvest at the end of the growing season when it's getting cool. So, you know, as opposed to, let's say, a hot weather vegetable that you're harvesting when the weather is hottest, a thing that you harvest when it's getting cooler, it's just easy. It's intrinsically easier to store it for long periods of time. So it's very, you know, it's a perfect vegetable for getting people through the winter. And indeed, you know, in many climates where sauerkraut is an important food, it historically has been a survival food, a way for people to have plant-based nutrients throughout a long winter where there are no fresh plant-based foods. You know, another aspect of this is, let's say, compared to the, you know, dark green vegetables that are, you know, also harvested in cool weather, let's say like kale or collards or things like that, cabbage has a relatively mild flavor. So I think that these are some of the reasons why cabbage is, you know, sort of so popular as a basis for fermentation.
Do you have another favorite cabbage recipe that you'd like to share that you found somewhere in the world?
Well, I mean, I should just say, like, I will never tire of sauerkraut.
Of course.
And, you know, I mean, sauerkraut is what I recommend for most people as a first fermentation project because it's super straightforward. You don't need to find any special starter cultures. You can enjoy your results relatively quickly. And to whatever degree people might be projecting their anxiety about bacteria onto the process of fermentation, sauerkraut is about as safe as food gets. I mean, there's really just no case history of illness or food poisoning from sauerkraut. Statistically speaking, it's much safer than just fresh raw vegetables. The fermentation makes the vegetables safer. So I think it's a great place to start. All you do is you chop cabbage, shred it, then you salt it. There's no magic number in terms of proportion of salt. Salt it lightly to taste. Then I like to get in and squeeze it for a couple of minutes, and what this does is it breaks down cell walls and makes it juicy. Once it's nice and juicy, you just pack it into your vessel, whether that's a jar that'll sit on your counter or a big crock that might sit in your cellar, and you just press down enough to get the vegetable submerged under liquid. And then you wait. And you can really do this with any vegetables. It doesn't have to be cabbages, but it works really, really wonderfully with cabbage. And cabbage maintains a nice crispiness for a long time under fermentation, as long as it's in a coolish environment. You know, I mean, in the book, I have lots of other, you know, interesting variations on fermenting vegetables. You know, I traveled to China primarily to learn about Chinese techniques for fermenting vegetables because throughout the literature, you know, the history of sauerkraut is represented as the people of Central Asia brought the notion of fermenting vegetables under a brine from China westward across Central Asia and into Europe. And, you know, the style that I learned about in China that I've been making ever since is a style called Pao Cai that uses a perpetual brine. So you create a brine, a saltwater solution, you know, with some spices. And, you know, and then you just keep on putting new veggies in and taking them out. And then, you know, over time you have to add more salt, add more seasonings because the salt and the seasonings migrate out with the vegetables that are being fermented in the brine. But, you know, it's a wonderful and really very versatile style. And I say versatile because, you know, just in the, you know, handful of homes that we visited in China, you know, everybody's Pao Cai was a little bit different and used a different seasoning. So, you know, that's one really wonderful way of fermenting. Another way that I learned for fermenting vegetables in my travels was actually from an avid fermentation experimentalist in Tasmania in Australia, this fellow named Adam James, who had created a perpetual pickling paste out of turmeric, garlic, and turnips. So we basically, you know, put a bunch of those into a food processor, with a little bit of water, turned it into a paste with some salt. And then, I mean, I made mine over a year ago, and I just keep on, you know, putting veggies in and pulling them out, and they're pickled. They have the beautiful bright color of the turmeric. They have flavor of the turmeric and the garlic, as well as the lactic acid that builds up in there. And so it becomes this perpetual medium for pickling, and then it's also a spice paste on its own. So, you know, I also just use the pickling paste itself as a condiment. So,
wow.
Sauerkraut is where I started. It's where I recommend that people start. But then, you know, there's really so many directions you can take vegetable fermentation from there.
I'd personally like to thank whomever that was in past history who came up with sauerkraut for the first time. Now, onions and garlic are the basis for so many things we cook, but I'm going to take you back to China. You add in, help me with the name of it, doubanjiang. Tell us about this.
Yeah.
Doubanjiang. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Sure. So doubanjiang is a fermented seasoning paste that comes from Sichuan province, and it's basically fava beans fermented with chili peppers. And it creates this bright red paste that's, you know, a combination of the spice and the color of the chilies, along with some funkiness and some of the flavor that's described as umami from the fermentation. And, you know, it's really a seasoning that underlies a lot of the Sichuanese cuisine. And it's really wonderful. And, we visited a town where it's made and saw a production facility and learned how it's made. And, I've been making it ever since at home. And it's also available, you can purchase it through the internet. It's a long process to make, but really worthwhile for people who are excited about fermentation.
Your descriptions of so many of the foods and recipes has me wanting to try every single one, but I'm going to take you to Switzerland. This sounded phenomenal, the fried potato tempeh. Tell us about that.
Sure. So tempeh is an Indonesian ferment typically made with soybeans. For years I have been experimenting and learning that, you can make tempeh with lots of different kinds of beans. They don't have to be soybeans. I've made lots of chickpea tempeh and pinto bean tempeh, and I have incorporated grains a lot. But in my travels, I've met some people who are doing, unusual experimental tempehs. And these folks that I met in Basel, Switzerland, were making tempeh with potatoes, and then you don't fry it until afterwards. But basically, the tempeh involves a fungus, and typically it would be binding together lightly cooked soybeans, and instead, in this case, it's binding together lightly cooked potatoes, and then the fungus actually binds the loose little pieces of potatoes into a cohesive sort of sheet, and then you cut slices off of it, and then you cook them. And in the case of the potatoes, if you fry them, it is just really out of this world.
Mm-hmm. Sandor, I like to try the wildest thing on a menu. So when I was in Mexico, I was told about huitlacoche, or black corn fungus. So is there anything that you won't try, and what has been kind of the wildest thing you've eaten and really enjoyed?
Well, I mean, there's very little that I won't try. I try to be adventurous, and I won't say that everything I've tried has
sure,
my favorite right away, or that I've loved everything I've tried, but I try to challenge myself to try flavors that aren't obvious to me. And, you know, what I want to say is that, you know, many of the flavors of fermentation are acquired tastes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not necessarily born loving them. I don't know anybody who, you know, loved beer the first time they tried it or loved coffee the first time that they tried it. I think about some of the stronger cheeses that I really love now.
Mm-hmm.
And, I picture myself as a kid tasting them and making a terrible face and not understanding why people like them.
Right.
But because I saw people relishing them, it gave me a reason to try them again. So sure, in my travels, I've been presented with all kinds of things that did not have obvious appeal to me. A lot of fermented foods are really, foods for survival through a long, harsh winter. And so, you know, if something doesn't jump out at me as being, smelling good, I can't wait to try it. That seems so delicious. You know, I really challenge myself to, you know, try to find what people find so delicious in it. I've really tasted, whatever I have been, presented with. And one of the interesting things is I find that some of the foods that the first time I tasted them, I found really challenging. Let's say Japanese natto. This is the whole fermented soybeans. And they're an example of an alkaline ferment. So rather than producing an acid byproduct like sauerkraut, or rather than producing alcohol as a byproduct, as in beer or wine, it's producing alkaline byproducts. And, you know, this gives it a little bit of an ammonia kind of a smell, but that's not entirely unfamiliar to anyone who's a cheese lover. Of course, you know, Brie and Camembert and similar cheeses also involve alkaline byproducts of fermentation, so we can relate to that. And it also has a kind of a mucilaginous, slimy coating on the beans, which I actually really love, but it turns out many people not familiar with textures of these find that rather challenging. But anyway, the first time I tried natto, I did not like it at all. But really through several, non-Japanese enthusiasts encouraging me to give it another go, I actually found that I like it. And now actually I love it, and I make natto all the time for myself. But one of the things I talk about in the book is drying natto. That in many places outside of Japan, there are very similar foods, but instead of being eaten in this sort of fresh and wet and somewhat slimy state, it's dried first. And I've been dehydrating natto, mixing it with roasted sesame seeds, salt, and other seasonings, and making these seasoning blends that I call special sauce. And I can tell you so many of my friends and acquaintances who I've shared this with, who might be squeamish about fresh natto, love this seasoning.
Wow.
So sometimes simply drying something is enough to make the food more accessible to people.
Wow, great point. Let's go to Callis. We've got Peter on the line. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead.
Well, I have absolutely loved Sanders' first book. And like him, the sauerkraut was our first one, but we have gone on to all sorts of things, and pickles is high on the list.
Yeah.
But one of our greatest successes was kimchi.
Mm.
Oh my gosh. We made kimchi, and it was so good that a fellow from Asia said, "That's the best kimchi you ever had."
Wow. High honor, Peter. Peter Burke.
It's high honors.
Oh,
and that year, we must have made 5 gallons of it.
Oh, that's fantastic. Boy, that's great to hear. Sander, when you hear someone like Peter who, you know, started with you, you know, as with sauerkraut and has gone on to try so many things, how does that make you feel about spreading the word about fermented products?
Well, I mean, it is, you know, it's incredibly gratifying to me, that the words that I've put down on paper have been able to help open up this, exciting world to people. And, there's no greater honor that I could imagine than, you know, getting to, you know, meet people who have been able to, you know, put my books to good use.
All right. I'm going to let you pick from a list of different things and tell us about some of your favorites here. I thought were interesting. Sauerkraut chocolate cake, or the Danchang egg sausages, or from Alaska, stinkheads.
Well, let's talk about sauerkraut chocolate cake.
Okay, good.
Which is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's something of a staple from, like, you know, Midwestern church cookbooks. But, you know, it's a way of making chocolate cake that maybe sounds shocking at first. But, you know, we hear about buttermilk cakes. We hear about carrot cake, zucchini cake. So think of it as like a cross between a buttermilk cake and a carrot cake. And, you know, it's basically using the acidity of the sauerkraut to help rise the cake. You know, having some vegetables in there actually keeps the cake really moist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, really, unless the person who makes the cake tells you that the sauerkraut is in it, you know, you would never realize that the sauerkraut is in it. It just blends right in the way the carrots in a carrot cake or the zucchinis in a zucchini bread do. So, you know, it's a really, really, like, delicious application of sauerkraut.
It absolutely sounds it. All right, we've got about 2 minutes left. We're both crazy for pickles. What are some interesting pickles that you have found in your travels that you'd love for people to enjoy?
Well, you know, I grew up with, you know, what we knew as sour pickles outside of New York. I think they're mostly known as kosher dill pickles, and they're, you know, cucumbers fermented in a brine with lots of garlic and dill. And I still make pickles like that. I mean, you know, this summer I made a bunch. I still have the last jar of pickles from this summer in my fridge, watching them disappear one by one. And it'll be a sad day when all of this year's pickles are gone. But, you know, pickles are something that are beloved around the world and made in so many different styles. And I talked earlier about pao cai, which is one Chinese style of pickles. Another Chinese style of pickles that I loved is actually making some starchy rice water, cooking a little bit of rice in a somewhat larger volume of water, then straining out the rice and eating it, and then you cool off that water and add some salt to that, and then use that to cover vegetables along with ginger and garlic, and it's this wonderful you know, rice water pickle. It's really, really lovely, and the starchy water really makes the fermentation happen, you know, faster and with stronger flavor. And it's really a wonderful variation. But there's no end to the variation in styles of pickles that people around the world eat. And, you know, in my book, I try to document some of them, but it's by no means comprehensive, and it's really just, you know, scratching the surface, because there's so much variety in so many different parts of the world in how people make pickles.
All right. 1 minute, one more item to tell us about.
Okay. Well, you asked about the egg sausages.
And yes.
In fact, they are not fermented, but since I, you know, sort of encountered them, you know, while learning about fermentation, I thought they would be an interesting thing to include. And it's basically sausages. You know, you take sausage casings, and then you fill them with a scrambled egg mixture, and then you place it in hot water and simmer it for 5 or 10 minutes until the egg sets, and then you remove it and cool it off a little bit and slice it into roughly 1-inch lengths. And then you put them in some soup that's ready and cook them a little bit more, and they expand out the edges, and they end up looking like these little two-headed mushrooms or like little macaroons or something.
Mm.
They're gorgeous. They're delicious. They're, you know, super fun and, you know, interesting to share with people, and pretty simple to make.
Sandor Alex Katz has given many workshops on fermentation. He has written numerous books on the topic, including his latest, Sandor Katz's Fermentation Journeys, Recipes, Techniques, and Traditions from Around the World. You can visit his website. It's called wildfermentation.com. Sandor, thanks for this wonderful hour. It was enjoyable.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care. We're going to hop out for CBS News, and then we'll be back to hear what's going on around the world and around the country from national correspondent Bob Ney. And don't forget, Governor Phil Scott is our guest this morning at 10:30. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingary. National correspondent Bob Ney joins us every week at this time, and looks like he dropped. He's right back with us, so let's get an update on what's happening in the world and the country. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. My hardline phone all of a sudden died.
Oh, no.
I needed to punt.
All right. Well, we've got you, and we're happy to have you again. Bob, let's go over the COVID numbers to start things.
Right, Rick. With the United States, the total deaths are 681,510. Now, the good news is that the cases are continuing to decline. Now, you're going to obviously hear a lot of information. In fact, I have a friend that made a horrific post. He got the Delta after getting a vaccination and is in really bad shape, he and his family. So we're still hearing about Delta. But in general, the new coronavirus cases are declining. The experts are saying, you know, they're cautiously optimistic. They think the virus will continue to decline, of course, if in fact there's more vaccinations. So it's still a little uncertain, but it seems that we're beginning to move in the right direction. The U.S. is now averaging 134,000 new cases a day. That is a 10% drop over the last 2 weeks when we talked.
That's still an awfully big number.
Big number.
Yeah, and 2,000 deaths per day. What will it take? Will this progress last, Bob?
Well, I think there's several things that, have to happen. First of all, more vaccinations. And I do understand, like my friend and his family, they've been vaccinated, but they still got the Delta variant, but they're surviving. So I still think caution with, hand sanitation, using the sanitizers, masks. I know that's a big debate. I'll be frank with you. I've been putting my mask on, going to stores. And of course, my father's 98. So, we're cautious with him. But again, that's a big debate because we don't have a mask mandate, where I live.
Nor we. And it is by choice, but I'm with you, vaccinated and mask back on, and doing all the things that, we have been taught to do over this year and a half.
Right.
Yeah, washing those hands vigorously. My hands are so clean and soft, Bob. I just got to tell you that. So.
Right. I'm going to buy stock and definitely in one of the hand sanitizer
right.
companies.
Well done. And the CDC saying it's booster time.
Okay, this one has been driving me crazy. Reading stories, over the last month, because I actually went to a pharmacy 3 weeks ago, asked about my dad getting the third booster. They said, yes, bring him in. Then I saw an article the next day where September the 20th was when they would tell you whether to get boosters or not. So I'm like, okay, what's the reality?
Yeah.
So here's what we know officially. The Pfizer booster, they're saying, is now available to over 65 or below 65 if you have certain health conditions, but they haven't weighed in on Moderna, but right now they're weighing in on Pfizer. I expect Moderna to be the next one. So that's what they're saying officially. If you're above 65, you can get the third shot and it would fortify your defenses. And then if you're below, if you're 50 to 64 with underlying medical conditions, then 6 months after you got your second shot, you can get your shot. Now, I'm taking, Rick, underlying medical conditions is pretty broad, probably going to be a lot of discretion at the local level.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to the January 6th committee. What are they finding out, or what have they been able to ascertain so far?
Well, this is going to be, a push comes to shove in a sense, because the House Select Committee, which is called the January 6th committee, about the hit at the Capitol. They've issued the subpoenas to two top Trump White White House officials, and that's former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, former Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Scavino, and also Kash Patel, who was serving as Chief of Staff to the Acting Defense Secretary that day. They want to know what I think the Defense Department was told or did. Now, also, there's an additional subpoena that's targeting somebody we kind of all have heard of, Steve Bannon, who was originally the big Trump guru that kind of fell out with him. Now, there's also a third piece to this, and I don't know how it's going to come down, but when a president leaves office, there's a national archiving. When somebody wants to release that archive material, for example, the last 2 days of the White House, it has to go to the former administration, this case Trump and his lawyers, and it goes to the Biden White House. Now, Trump's lawyers are claiming executive privilege, but I don't think that lasts after a president leaves on this material. So I'm going to weigh in here, Rick, probably that this decision to release or not that information is going to rest with President Biden.
Very interesting.
We'll see what he does.
Now, one of the things that really stirred people up for that January 6th insurrection were the presidential results and the idea that they were incorrect, that the the presidency was stolen from Donald Trump. Now we have the Arizona recount. What happened there?
Well, this recount is a review that was ordered by Arizona Republicans. And so that's the important, you know, we're kind of saving the headline, I guess, in the for the beginning. But it was reviewed and ordered by Arizona Republicans, and it confirms that Donald Trump lost to President Biden in the very critical Maricopa County. So they can, Trump people can still argue, the lawyers, you know, that it was stolen from him, but this audit is a setback when you look at Arizona, because, again, it was requested by the Republicans, not the Democrats.
All right. Talking about setbacks, there's one for Joe Biden with his $3.5 trillion initiative derailed in West Virginia. So tell us what's going on with that.
Well, if the president or Nancy Pelosi or Senator Schumer are listening to your show this morning, or if
I believe they all are.
If they would accept a conference call from Rick and Bob, we can solve this in the next 5 minutes.
Yes.
President Biden is set back on the, you know, this was his kind of New Deal, kind of the, you know, the Lyndon Johnson, you know, Great Frontier and sort of the FDR New Deal. This was his with the $3.5 trillion human infrastructure bill. And the bottom line is this. There are 50 senators exactly in the Senate. You need 50 senators exactly to pass this. Right now, they have 49. And they can scream about Republicans not helping all day long. They're missing Senator Manchin.
Right.
Senator Manchin has been called face-to-face with the president. I've been called face-to-face with two presidents. It's very uncomfortable, trust me. You try to squirm and figure a way out to compromise, right? Well, Manchin didn't do that with Biden. He said no. So it's very easy math. They are whatever, you know, however they want to spin it, they're a vote short.
Right.
They need, and actually, to be frank about this, Rick, they're probably two or three votes short. Manchin's the out front guy, you know.
Sure.
There's nothing they can do to defeat him in the primary. There's nothing they can do to defeat him in a general election. So unless he quits the Senate tomorrow, they need to, well, that's a good idea. They should guarantee him a Supreme Court appointment. The next one. But,
nice.
But the bottom line is they don't have the numbers, and they're going to have to adjust to a number that he sets. So right now it's high noon. The president has definitely lost, you know, on this one.
Yeah, and it's time to find what Joe Manchin's number is. All right, let's move to Afghanistan. Taliban rule now, and pretty much as expected, right, Bob?
Just what we thought. I have been to Afghanistan twice. I personally heard the horrific stories from Afghan people of just the terrible evil that the Taliban perpetrated when they ruled the country. They're back in power. It sure didn't last long, the new Taliban, how they were going to be. They're going to go back to hand amputations, executions. They're just going to not do it publicly in the arena they used to do it. They're going to probably do it more privately, but they are right back to where we thought they would be.
And there's some controversy, confusion regarding how many Americans still in Afghanistan. We're continuing to evacuate who's left slowly, but some politicians not too happy about what's going on, about the information they're being fed by the White House.
Right. There was a classified private briefing, which happened with Republican and Democratic lawmakers, who are, you know, members of the Foreign Affairs Committee, you know, et cetera. They had the top people there. They had the State Department, the Pentagon, Homeland Security, National Security Agency. They had everybody. And at one point in time, both sides of the aisle, members from both sides of the aisle, got up and walked out of the room and said, okay, goodbye. Hmm. And it's because they weren't getting answers, not the answers they want or didn't want, but they weren't getting answers. And a lot of it focused, there's more because we don't know. It's a classified briefing, but we do know, Rick, that part of it was the fact that they can't or won't say how many Americans are left over there. You know, we keep hearing different numbers, and it really frustrated the lawmakers. And I think they probably said, when you get your act together, call us again.
Wow.
But everybody walked out of the meeting.
That's not good. Rutland High School decided to change its athletic team's mascot from Raiders to Ravens. Period. End of story. Oh, well, not so fast. That's when the fun actually really started. Allison Novak writes about education for 7 days, has been following this story. She joins us now. Allison, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me.
Allison, how and when did the whole issue of changing the mascot name come about in Rutland?
So last October, the Rutland City School Board voted to retire the Raiders mascot after a group of alumni and students raised the point that it perpetuated racist stereotypes and kind of organized to form a campaign to change the name. So that was almost a year ago. And then there was a committee formed that was made up of students to pick a new name, and the Ravens name was chosen. And in February, it was presented to the school board and also approved by a 6-4 vote. But since then, things have kind of, as you said, stalled. And there's a number of reasons why they've stalled, but essentially, in March, on town meeting day, there were three candidates for the school board who had run on a pro Raiders campaign. So basically saying that they would try to bring back the Raiders name if they won. And all three of them won. And so that basically tipped the scales of the school board. So it became majority pro Raiders. And so there's been some different stalling techniques to make it so that the Ravens name has not been implemented yet.
Well, let's talk about the name Raiders, because, you know, there's a team that plays in the NFL called the Oakland Raiders, and their mascot is a buccaneer, a pirate. So what was the problem with the Rutland Raiders name?
So the people that were part of the campaign to change it kind of went back and looked at, like, newspaper clippings from, you know, the 50s and 60s, and essentially, you know, it was associated with Native Americans. There was an arrowhead logo, which is still used on, you know, uniforms right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was basically perpetuated negative stereotypes of Native Americans. So they kind of drew, they kind of pointed to the history to show that this is historically what the name was all about.
Was there ever an idea of keeping the name Raiders and changing the mascot to something more like the Oakland Raiders before abandoning the name completely?
Yeah, there were several people who kind of suggested that rebranding idea, but I think the people who argued for the name change felt that, like, rebranding wasn't enough, that changing the name would be the most appropriate thing.
So have they found a new logo and started to adopt that?
Well, so what's happened is the new board chair, Hurley Kavakis, in the spring, he basically called for a review of the process for how the name was changed to make sure it was done on the up and up. And that just was completed in September, early September. And so the review found that the name change process was valid. But the school board will meet next week to kind of discuss what will happen next. And what the school administrators, the superintendent and principal of the high school have told me is that they don't want to push forward with a new mascot until the board has kind of is finished deliberating on this issue. So, you know, there were some students who told me they really pushed to try to get a new mascot image. One student who graduated last year said he had a table set up with all sorts of images that were created with graphic designers, and the principal actually removed the table and told him he wasn't allowed to have it up because it was too soon to start picking a new image.
So the next step in all this is the board getting together next week. They have found that the process is legitimate, but is that really going to change the minds of the board, which I think right now kind of tips in favor of maintaining or reinstating the Raiders nickname?
Yeah, everyone I asked kind of felt like it was unclear about what was going to happen next week on September 28th at the next board meeting. I did talk to the board chair, Hurley Kavakis, who said it is possible that there will be a motion made to reinstate the Raiders' name. There also could be a, motion to just continue on with the Ravens, or I guess there wouldn't have to be a motion. They could just decide to continue on with the Ravens because mm-hmm. that was what was voted on. But I think, I think it's a little unclear, so I'll be watching definitely to see what happens because the last couple of board meetings have been pretty contentious. I've watched in reporting this article, I kind of went back and watched all of them, and there's a lot of kind of bickering between members of the board, and some students I talked to pointed out this is really not the role modeling that adults should be showing to kind of the high school kids and the young people who are kind of looking and watching this happen.
Yeah. Allison, they're back in school. The teams are playing again. So are they just going with an R or no logo or what? How are the Rutland High School teams clad right now as they go into battle?
So they do still have Raiders uniforms because, that process of changing the uniforms costs money and, takes some time. I have been told that the cheerleaders were asked to refrain from using the Raiders name and just say go Rutland. So I think that's what's happening when it comes to the cheerleaders. But I do know, looking at some local papers that, people and the fans have been, cheering go Raiders. One of the board members told me that the announcer actually at the first home football game of the season, the announcer was actually still saying Raiders, which he complained about. So the change has not really been codified yet.
Gotcha. Now, didn't the Vermont Principals Association issue a directive about mascots and names for high schools?
They did. So that happened last summer in August, basically saying that the Vermont Principals Association said that any mascot that has a marginalizing or exclusionary elements or did in the past should be replaced. And Danville was one school that voted in March to retire their Indians mascot, and that is something that's going forward. So, there's, I think, both a state and kind of federal wave to change mascots that refer to Native Americans. If the Rutland School Board voted to kind of go back, they'd kind of be going against this tie.
Hmm. Yeah, in our area, Dartmouth College years ago went from Indians to Big Green. In the last two seasons now, the Washington former Redskins have been playing as the Washington football team. The real stakeholders, Native Americans, have they weighed in on this?
Yes, they have. So there was a national group that both in the fall when the name was being contemplated to be changed, and then also in the spring, the National Congress of American Indians wrote to the Rutland School Board and to the administrators there saying that they believe that the Raiders mascot should be retired.
Hmm. I would imagine the leadership of the high school, the school district, have come out one way or another, have they?
You know, they really haven't. And that was the interesting thing I found in my reporting. You know, when South Burlington went through this a couple of years ago, the principal there, Patrick Burke, who I talked to for the story, the principal of South Burlington High School and the superintendent in South Burlington, Dave Young, both kind of expressed their strong support for changing the rebel's name. But we have not really heard anything from Superintendent Bill Olson and Rutland High School Principal Greg Schillinger. They've basically kind of stayed mum on it. They've told me that they are kind of talking to board members about it, but they haven't kind of come out and said what they believe should happen.
South Burlington changing the name from Rebels to Wolves. It was very contentious. As a matter of fact, that argument really kind of hurt the school as they tried to get a school budget passed afterwards, right?
Yeah, so after the name change was voted on, it was approved unanimously by the school board to change the name. In the ensuing months, the school budget was defeated twice, and there was a number of other incidents. The athletic field was defaced with racist graffiti, and rebel supporters actually sued the school district. And in 2018, the Vermont Supreme Court basically said that the people who sued were saying that the mascot should be put to a citywide referendum, a city vote, and the Vermont Supreme Court rejected that argument. It was a long drawn out process, and Patrick Burke, the principal at South Burlington High School, said it was really tough and he didn't know if it was going to get better, and he consulted with other principals around the country who had gone through similar things, and they all said, hang in there, it's going to get better, and he didn't really believe them. But he said now, you know, 3 or 4 years later, he feels that the SB Wolves is kind of one of the most unifying parts of the school culture for students.
Interesting. Back to Rutland. Most importantly, has the board been able to maintain its focus on what really matters, education?
Well, I think different people would say different things about that, but they definitely spent quite a lot of time talking about the mascot. And obviously, this is a very tough time for education with the pandemic still kind of dragging on. So, you know, some have said, like, this needs to just be put to rest. They need to move on. They need to go ahead with the Ravens name and stop bickering and arguing about this because it's wasting time.
Yeah, it really seems like a diversion that shouldn't be what divides a community, but seems to be in Rutland. You can find Allison's story in this week's edition of 7 Days or online at 7daysvt.com. Allison, thanks so much for being with us again this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right, you take care. All right, we're going to be back after a special news report, and we'll have Governor Phil Scott on with us until 11. And listeners, to ask Governor Scott a question, you can hop on the phones now, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingary. Even without a worldwide pandemic to deal with for a year and a half, serving as governor is a busy enough job. So we really appreciate that Governor Phil Scott is able to join us this morning. Governor Scott, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, good morning, Rick, and thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Listeners, if you've got a question for the governor, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Governor, COVID numbers have really spiked again in the state, daily cases in triple digits again. How concerned are you about that?
Well, again, always concerned. I have been concerned from the very beginning, but we still know, looking at the data, looking at the numbers, we're the most vaccinated state in the country. We have the lowest hospitalization rate. And while we've seen cases rise across the country, Our high vaccination rate has helped dampen the severe impacts here in Vermont. So we're steady. It's not elevated to a point where we should be panicked at all, because again, we need to get more shots in arms with the single best tool we have from moving from the pandemic to endemic is the vaccines. And that's why we're concentrating so heavily on that.
Well, not panicking has really been the way you've approached this throughout for all these months. But, you know, with this Delta variant, it spreads more easily. For those who are not vaccinated, it does have serious repercussions. What would it take to make that decision to declare a state of emergency again in the state of Vermont?
Well, again, Rick, you hit the nail on the head in some respects. Dr. Walensky from the CDC, the director of the CDC, coined the phrase, I think, we're seeing a pandemic of the unvaccinated. So with our high number of, in terms of vaccination, we're in good shape here, but we're seeing this gap, between the vaccinated and unvaccinated widening, when it comes to cases and hospitalizations. So there's no, there's no one number that would trigger a state of emergency, but we can't abuse it either. We can't be in this perpetual state of emergency because we lose people that way too. We have to make sure there's an emergency to respond to, you know, an action that would respond to the emergency. But what I look at and what our team looks at from the very beginning is protecting our healthcare system, making sure that we can take care of people and that we don't have overflows and we can take care of people in need. So, again, we're steady. They're elevated more than we'd like. But we, you know, we're seeing some encouraging reports. Saw some last night. And hopefully this is a trend that will continue. But we had back in January, February, March, in that area, we had a high of upwards in the upper 60s in hospitalizations due to COVID. Mm-hmm. And right now we're hovering in the low 40s.
I know you've strongly urged people to wear masks again indoors in groups. And I realize mask mandates are extremely unpopular, but aren't we in a situation where public safety is seriously at risk and you'd consider again having us all wear masks?
Well, again, we can encourage masks, which we've done. We've encouraged school districts to enforce that mandate in schools. We think it's a good idea. All but one district in Vermont, which accounted for one school, by the way, has implemented the guidance that we suggested. So essentially, we have a mask mandate in schools. And we're encouraging people in situations when they're inside, especially with large numbers inside, to wear a mask when you don't know the people around you. Be aware of your surroundings, so to speak. But again, to put forth a mask mandate would take a state of emergency. And I just don't think it's appropriate at this point in time.
With directives, what directives have you received from the Biden administration regarding the vaccination mandate of sorts that they're rolling out on October 1st?
Yeah, well, we're very much prepared for this. This is the booster shots that I think that's what you're talking about. But we're rolling them out as we speak, effective today. Those 80 and older can sign up. But I want to remind everyone, this is for the Pfizer vaccine. This is not for the other, not for Moderna or Johnson & Johnson at this point in time, just the Pfizer. So if you had the Pfizer vaccine and you're 80 or older, you can sign up today. On Monday, we are going to sign up, register those 75 and over. On Wednesday, 70 and over, and then followed by 65 and over on Friday. But you can also go through your healthcare provider or pharmacy right now. We'll be giving the first vaccination tomorrow. We've started, again, registering people this morning, and we'll be vaccinating folks at mass vax sites beginning tomorrow.
We've talked about, you know, how important it is for those, or how right now kind of precarious it is for those who are unvaccinated. You know, we're at 85%. It seems like, boy, that's a great number. No one else can, you know, crow about what we've been able to accomplish. But what efforts are you making to try to close that gap, you know, that other 15% in Vermont who have not been vaccinated so far?
Yeah, again, it's actually a little bit higher than for at least a single dose for those who are eligible. It's up over, it's over 87% at this point in time. And I think it's a good idea for businesses to follow our lead. We, as you might have read and learned, we have put together an opportunity for state employees to be vaccinated. And if they don't choose to vaccinate, they have to wear masks and do weekly testing. So we've encouraged other employers to follow suit. I think there are a number that who have. And as a foreign business owner myself, that's what I would have done in this situation. So giving people the option, not a mass mandate, but a vaccine mandate, but an option, either vaccinate or you wear a mask and test.
Mm-hmm. How are we doing with getting children 12 and over vaccinated so far?
Yeah, we're in pretty good shape in that category. I don't have it in front of me, but Commissioner Pichek takes care of the modeling and takes care of watching that data and gives it to us on a weekly basis. So we'll be getting an update on Tuesday. But I think where we struggle a bit are those 18 to 29. That's the category that where we struggle the most, and that's why we're encouraging employers to take some responsibility here, because it's in their best interest, both for the health of their workforce, but also in for their business as well, for their customers, but as well making sure that there aren't people out sick. So. Again, the president's executive order on vaccines, and again, I appreciate the goal. I want people to be vaccinated, but I prefer somewhat of a carrot approach than a stick. In Vermont, we've focused more on encouragement, and that's what we're going to continue to try to do. So we'll see when all of the intricacies of the executive order come out, what this means. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, you know, we're just encouraging people to get vaccinated. It's the best tool we have in the toolbox.
Indeed. Let's take a call now from Northfield. Jim joins us. Hi, Jim.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. 2 points. One, I haven't heard too much about therapeutics, such as monoclonal infusions, the use of azithromycin with oxy, ivermectin, the idea of using zinc and what have you. I haven't heard too much about the therapeutics. I know several people that were let go from the hospital, went home, basically call us if you get worse, when there are therapeutics out there that do work. Secondly, I do want to mention that the Delta variant is an exacerbation of those who have been vaccinated, not the unvaccinated, that the morphism, if you will, from to the Delta variant as a result of those who have been vaccinated, and shaming the vaccinated, even though I'm vaccinated, and coercion and reprisals is just wrong. That was part of the Nuremberg Code of Ethics, that we will not pressure, we will not coerce, neither will we use reprisals. Threats of reprisals, and all of this is going down. It's being this whole virus is being politically demonized. So
Well, Jim,
I've said a lot there, so
yeah, you have.
I'll stop.
All right, and let's let Governor Scott address those. I know it's it would probably be great to have the health commissioner with you right now, Dr. Levine. But
yeah.
You know, Governor Scott, how do you respond to those?
Yeah, Dr. Levine has spoken about some of the therapies as well. Some he agrees with, some he does not. And he talks about that a lot on Tuesdays. We answer a lot of questions, or he does, in terms of those products. So I would encourage you to listen in. I'm sure it comes up every single week, it seems as though. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Levine has a good sense of what he feels is working, what doesn't. So, again, I would encourage you to listen in on Tuesday. And in terms of, you know, I'm not going to debate, obviously, the caller. Mm-hmm. Has a lot of knowledge on this this issue, but we know that the vaccines that we have do have an effect on the Delta variant, and can help prevent serious illness and hospitalizations. So and they're not 100%, they're not perfect, but they're 85 or 90% effective. So what we see is there are some cases that work around the vaccine, and that's unfortunate. But for the vast majority of Vermonters, it works. I mean, look at what our success rate has been, and we continue to have the lowest per capita number of hospitalizations in the country. So we're doing something right.
And Jim also mentioned the idea of coercion. Now, up to this point, I don't know that there have been any real mandates by any businesses or government in the state where someone had to get vaccinated, although we've reached a level of 87%. You know, have you coerced anybody? Have you been shaming people into getting the vaccination, Governor?
Yeah, I don't think it's the right approach either. I do believe that people need options, and that's why we provided that option to state employees. If they, again, we would prefer that they get vaccinated, but if they choose not to, they just have to wear a mask and get tested weekly. So I think giving people options is the best approach. The carrot versus the stick approach is always better, and that's what we've done from the beginning, and we've had a lot of success in doing so.
Let's talk a little bit more about booster shots, Governor Scott. I guess it looks like it'll happen. What is the state's plan at this point if we go to boosters or when we go to booster shots?
Yeah, well, again, we started signing people up this morning. We received word. We got the go-ahead, so to speak, from the federal government. So we're probably leading the nation in terms of putting that into action. So we'll start putting shots in arms tomorrow. The first appointment, I think, is tomorrow morning. So and we'll continue to do that throughout the next week. So if you want to schedule your booster, you should go to online, healthvermont.gov/myvaccine. Or if you prefer, give us a call at 855-722-7878. So again, I just want to remind everyone, this approval from the FDA and the CDC is for the Pfizer vaccine only. So anyone else, if you've received the Moderna, the J&J, you're not eligible for a booster at this point in time. But if you're 65 and older and you received the Pfizer, you can sign up with us now. The CDC director, Dr. Walensky, also announced during the night, I think it was around 2 a.m., released a statement that they're going to expand on that, and we'll be ready for that as well. We've taken that into account. So we think we can get through these boosters over the next month and a half, and get everyone who is eligible a shot if they so choose.
And
we encourage it.
Does someone have to have had the second shot at least 6 months ago, Governor?
That's correct. Correct. 6 months ago, unless you have other conditions that would warrant, and you could do that through your provider, that would warrant a booster beforehand.
Okay.
And they call that third shot, not the booster. But yes, 6 months.
Okay, and that is for the Pfizer shot only. Let me give that toll-free number again, 855-722-7878. Going to Montpelier next.
That's and 80 and over today.
80 and over today, okay. On to Montpelier, and let's talk to Jesse. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I guess my comment is around, you know, hesitancy of people with vaccinations and kind of grouping folks that are hesitant into you know, sort of a political grouping, and that, you know, they're either right wing or they're, you know, sort of fringe. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are a lot of folks that are hesitant to take immunizations in general because of the history of pharmaceutical companies, you know, not being honest about side effects, not very good tracking of side effects, and not really looking for long-term side effects. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is a lot of hesitancy with people around, you know, health, you know, more natural approaches to health and philosophical approaches that are not really being addressed in the conversation. And I think that if we really want to combat vaccine hesitancy, it's a larger issue of corporations sort of having in their midst in, you know, politics and being able to, you know, control things like we see, you know, oftentimes, you know, in this country where, you know, companies are sort of having their way with the systems and rules are being rewritten for them.
Well, Jesse, your point is absolutely fair, that to say that it is one group, one party, one philosophy who has been hesitant is correct. That is not the way it should be. I think each person who has not gotten a vaccine has certainly made the decision on their own. But Governor Scott, the idea of, you know, corporations behind the vaccine, would we have been able to get the millions of doses so far if it wasn't for, unfortunately, the large pharmaceutical companies that Jesse points to?
Yeah, first of all, it is unfortunate that this turn took a political twist from the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
Because what we need to do is all be on the same page and try and end this pandemic. It will be with us. It's going to be an endemic. It's going to be like the flu for the next number of years, but it's something that we can mitigate. And having said that, as you brought up, it's important that we have partners. The pharmaceuticals are the one they set forth and worked in record time to develop this vaccine in three different platforms, three different companies, or more. Actually, there's only been three approved here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty remarkable when you think about the actual time element there, and you have to give the former administration credit for doing so. Now, again, what we need to do is to listen to the CDC, the FDA, and that's why they take their time. And it shouldn't be based on political pressure. It should be based on the science and the data. And I feel as though they're doing that, and we saw that of late. They're not moving forward in certain areas, and we just have to listen to the scientists.
Yeah, and I think Jesse's other point on tracking the efficacy of the vaccine is a good one as well. We have just about a minute left, Governor. You recently extended the Hotel Housing for Homeless Vermonters program for another month. Why was this necessary?
Well, again, we are all on the same page at one point in time. The legislature and partners put this date forward where we were going to roll back and actually, people were going to come to the limits of the emergency usage for the hotel motel program. At one point, it was like 30 days, as was the emergency. It was extended to like 84 days, and a lot of folks are coming to the end of that 84 days. But having said all that, we were all on the same page and had put it actually into law when this would end for some people. That being said, there's been some new information. The FEMA has decided they're going to be able to pay for this until the end of the year, or have given us that option.
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone's not on the same page at this point, and we need to get back on the same page. We don't need to fight about this. I feel as though a 30-day extension will give us the opportunity to get back together and figure out how we can get to permanent housing. We don't want temporary housing. We don't want emergency housing. We want permanent housing for those in need.
Okay. Governor Phil Scott, always a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks very much, Rick. Appreciate it.
All right, take care. That's our show for today, Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. And Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah up next. I'm Rick Singeri. Monday, we're going to go to the Vermont Granite Museum, find out about what's up at Champlain College, and also at the Montpelier Development Corporation. I'll meet you back here on Monday.